So, sleep. First, tell me why it's so important to us.
Well, we spend a third of our lives sleeping. And the reasons why we sleep are really only becoming more clear in terms of scientific and medical research. We use sleep for many functions. Number one, to allow us to put short-term memory and to put it into our long-term memory banks in the computer that is our brain. And then we also are finding that sleep is a period of time when we clear the brain of toxins, particularly toxins that have been reported to be responsible for the diseases such as Alzheimer's disease and in some cases Parkinson's disease. So sleep is a very critical component of our daily lives. And all of us know how we feel if we don't get a night of sleep. The next day, our ability to function is severely impaired. Our ability to remember, to interact with friends and workers, etc., is limited. So sleep on a night-to-night basis is important, as is long-term ability to sleep well.
All right, so most people, you know, some people say, oh, I can get by on 4 hours. But we know that's not true. What is a good average for the average adult?
The National Sleep Foundation has looked at hundreds of thousands of people for many, many years. And what they've determined that the optimal sleep for somebody who is in their 30s, 40s, and 50s is about 7 hours and 20 minutes per night. And there are people who do okay sleeping less, and there are people who do okay sleeping more. But there is a very interesting curve. It's called a U-shaped curve. And a fascinating finding was that people who sleep less than 7.5 hours or more than 7.5 hours per night, if you're in or above the age of 30, there is an increased mortality from all causes. So the idea that 7 hours and 20 to 30 minutes of sleep is necessary comes about because there is a risk to one's health if one goes above it or below it.
Okay, so we're not talking about 8 hours, 8.5. We're talking about 10, 11, 12 as above, right?
No, well, we're even, there is a slight increase at 8 hours, and the curve goes way up when you sleep 10 or more hours, as does the curve when you're sleeping less than 5 hours. But the curve starts to go up very rapidly at those points, but there is a very slight increase in the development of all kinds of illnesses, even if you're 30 minutes or 60 minutes in either direction of that 7.5 hour point.
Do we have any idea why?
No, we don't. But we have some ideas. There's the idea that, as I said, the brain needs a full night of sleep in order to do its job, and that is to clear the brain of toxins. We also know that the brain needs that amount of time to reset different body hormones. We know that there are diseases that can fragment sleep, and even if you're in bed for 7.5 hours, if you're not sleeping for that period of time, because it's disrupted by such illnesses as sleep apnea, even insomnia, the need to urinate frequently, something we call nocturia, then you are also subject to that kind of health consequence. So the idea that if you're in bed and you're not sleeping and can't sleep, you really need to get that checked out. And just having your doctor giving you a sleeping pill is more often than not the right thing to do. And the doctor or whoever your healthcare practitioner is needs to ask some questions about what it is that is interrupting your sleep. And if he or she can't determine what that is or the best treatment for it, by all means ask to be referred to a sleep specialist.
Most of us think, well, sleep apnea, yeah, that's not a big deal. It just means we can't sleep as well. But it can be a very huge deal. You want to talk
about it is that? A huge deal. The morbidity and mortality from untreated sleep apnea is enormous. It's associated with an increased amount of heart attacks. It's an increased amount of diabetes and various, and stroke as well. So these are very major health consequences of sleep apnea. Sleep apnea is not just snoring. Sleep apnea is literally stopping breathing, which drives down oxygen in your blood, drives up carbon dioxide, increases the degree of sleep fragmentation, increases stress hormone production. So there is a whole cascade of events that occur with sleep apnea that is far more serious than just snoring.
Well, we know snoring is a symptom, but what are the other symptoms that really we should look out for?
One of the major ones, sure. Loud snoring, observations by the bed partner that there are periods where you seem to stop breathing, where the snoring cuts out for 30 seconds, perhaps 60 seconds, and then resumes with a snort, followed by multiple awakenings at night to use the restroom. We call that nocturia. Or the development during the day of excessive daytime sleepiness, falling asleep at inappropriate times or places. There are patients, and I've had them, who have fallen asleep at red lights, fallen asleep at meetings, fallen asleep while working on their computer. This is serious consequences of that sleep apnea. And if you have those symptoms, snoring, bed partner reports of periods where the snoring seems to cut out, multiple times waking up to use the restroom, and daytime sleepiness, those are very clear indications that the individual needs to be evaluated by a sleep doctor.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about caffeine and alcohol, how they affect our sleep.
Sure. Alcohol has been used for thousands of years. It was the very first sleeping preparation because all of us know that alcohol is a sedative when you first drink it. It calms the nervous system down. In fact, it's called a central nervous system depressant. But the problem is that most people don't know that as alcohol is being metabolized by the body, as it's being cleared out of the bloodstream, it is turned into a stimulant. So about 4 hours after you finish drinking, and it doesn't matter whether it's wine, beer, or, quote, hard liquor, that sedative is now turned into this stimulant. And this is why people who drink themselves to sleep find that they wake up 3 to 4 hours later, unable to go back to sleep, feeling literally wound up, and if they do sleep, they have increased dreams and usually turns into nightmares, and the sleep for the rest of the night is terribly, terribly fragmented. So alcohol should never be used as a sleeping aid. The last alcohol consumption should be between 5 and 6 hours before your desired bedtime. Caffeine is a stimulant. Caffeine is a diuretic, meaning it causes an increased amount of urinary production. So if you drink caffeine right up until the time you go to sleep, your body is competing with that stimulant that's in your bloodstream, so your ability to fall asleep is impaired, your ability to stay asleep is impaired, and you're going to be producing more urine and having to wake up multiple times to empty your bladder. So people say, oh, I can drink coffee right up until I go to sleep. Well, that's not true because the caffeine will affect how well you sleep, the depth of your sleep, and the kind of sleep that you're getting. And both of those should be avoided, as I said, somewhere between 5 to 6 hours before bedtime.
Okay, and this one's really one I've never heard before about, you know, we always talk about sleeping in on the weekend to catch up on our rest, but you say that doesn't work.
If you have spent, let's say, a Friday night or a Thursday night working all night, well, you can catch up a little bit on what we call a sleep debt. But if you do this on a regular basis, sleep in on Saturday and Sunday, then catching and being able to awaken at a normal work time on Monday morning is terribly impaired, because what you've done is you've shifted your internal clock. And that's why we call it Monday morning blues, because lots of people do that. It's like what we just experienced last week with the change in time for daylight savings time. You lose an hour of sleep, so when you wake up on Monday morning, you have not had enough sleep in order to fully satisfy your body's needs. So you wake up feeling groggy, you wake up feeling kind of mentally fuzzy, and it takes a while for that to clear. So sleeping in on weekends and then jumping back into your normal routine on Monday is very difficult. In fact, it's been shown that just from daylight savings time, when we spring ahead, there is an increased amount of heart attacks on that Monday and Tuesday following the change in the clock settings. So there are definite physiologic events and consequences of this sleeping in or cutting out an hour of your sleep.
Wow, that's scary. So do you have some tips for us on how to get a good night's sleep?
The best thing I can tell you is that one should maintain a regular and routine sleep-wake cycle. Don't change on weekends and holidays. When you first get into bed at night, don't swaddle yourself and don't go to sleep in a warm environment. As body temperature cools at night, it aids with sleep onset. Avoid the alcohol, avoid the caffeine, and a bed should be used for one of two things only, and I don't think I need to spell out what those two things are. And if you're not doing one or the other, you shouldn't be in the bed. Don't associate the bed with torture because you can't fall asleep. If you find that you're unable to fall asleep after 20 minutes or so, get out of the bed. Go to another room. Read a non-active book. Use a Kindle or an iPad on night mode, because one of the things you don't want to do is expose your eyes to bright light. And both Kindle and the iPad have what we call night settings, which is a black screen where the letters of the book or article that you're reading are in white. So the amount of light that's entering the eye is reduced by about 75% from a normal reading mode. People who sit there with their iPhones, their computers, their iPads just before bed, where this bright light is hitting the eye, they are causing the natural sleep hormone in the brain to either shut down or to be greatly diminished in production. And that, in some people, can make sleep onset and to be able to stay asleep very difficult. So these are some of the common and easy things to do in order to ensure that you're going to get a good night's sleep.
Okay, do we have a website or somewhere that people can find more information?
Sure. There are several. The National Sleep Foundation has a very helpful website. I have a website that's called sleepandneurology.com, and the American Academy of Sleep Medicine has a website, aasm.org. All of these websites can help people with questions they have about their sleep, and if they need to have further medical intervention because of their sleep disorders, they can find information on these sites where they can get help.
Great. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I just want to tell everybody that sleep is a wonderful thing, and I wish all my patients a good night's sleep and pleasant dreams.
Thank you so much.